Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer at WNYC. By the way, speaking of the State of the City address, which Mayor Bloomberg is expected to give at 1 o'clock this afternoon, we'll be streaming that live on our politics website. It's freecountry.org. You can react to it there then. And, of course, we'll have excerpts from the State of the City address here on the Brian Lehrer Show tomorrow morning and your reactions. We will also ask you tomorrow to suggest what he and the mayor of Pittsburgh might bet each other over the big Jets-Steelers AFC championship game coming this Sunday. What classic New York item for what classic bit of Pittsburgh lore, whatever that is. And we know that many of you, New York chauvinists are sneering right now saying, oh, yeah, right, well, I could think of 25 New York things. What do they have in Pittsburgh? Well, we'll find out tomorrow. We'll get people from Pittsburgh, and we know there are plenty of people from Pittsburgh who live in our area, to tell us what it is that the two mayors may bet each other. And the thing is that they're actually asking for suggestions. They're not just saying, okay, I'm going to bet you a New York corned beef sandwich for Pittsburgh, whatever it is. They're actually crowdsourcing this. So we'll have you participate tomorrow here on The Brian Lehrer Show. Now, we talked last hour about the WikiLeaks State Department cables as a factor in the Jasmine Revolution now taking place in Tunisia. But let's go deeper. Just before things really started getting hot there, NYU new media professor Clay Shirky wrote an article in Foreign Affairs called The Political Power of Social Media. He was last here to discuss his current book, Cognitive Surplus, Creativity and Generosity in a Connected Age. So, Clay Shirky, welcome back to WNYC. Hi.
Hey, Brian. How are you?
Okay, thanks. And your article came out before the Tunisia Revolution began. You wrote that change from social media is measured in years and decades rather than weeks or months. Has anything happened in Tunisia that's making you reexamine that?
No, I think that the Tunisian example essentially is the end of a long process rather than the replacement for a long process. Many people have pointed out, right, that Tunisia has been sinking into unemployment and the graft and corruption in the Ben Ali regime has been rising for some time now. And while certainly the exciting moment to watch from abroad is the moment of uprising, the moment of collapse. It's when people take to the streets. That is, in a way, the newsworthy event. What happens before that is that a populace kind of knows its own mind. It's not just that each person realizes, the regime is corrupt or there are not enough jobs, but each person realizes that everybody else knows it too. And it's that synchronizing effect in advance of an uprising or a political change that is, I think, the long-term political contribution potentially of social media, which is to help people converse with one another, understand what's going on in their governments, and then when they decide to take act, to be able to do so in a synchronized way. So I think that social media certainly, had a contextual effect on the Jasmine Revolution, but it was in many ways, it certainly didn't cause it, because what caused it was people's dissatisfaction with the Ben Ali regime.
Right.
But I think we will see more and more people using these social tools as ways of getting citizenry to understand amongst themselves what's going on and what their reaction should be.
Listeners, anything you want to say or ask about the role of social media in foreign affairs, in international politics, or in political power at all? That's the title of Clay Shirky's article in Foreign Affairs magazine, Political Power of Social Media, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or at WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. And your article is partly about how the Internet has become ubiquitous enough that American foreign policy interests are affected by the change.
So, right.
So talk about that and what policy choices that poses for the U.S. government.
Well, it was complicated when I wrote it, and I wrote it before Cablegate. So I wrote wrote it before the tranche of foreign policy cables leaked. We, you know, people sort of largely assumed by Bradley Manning and then promulgated by WikiLeaks. That makes it even more complicated. The issues, in a way, for the State Department are that we have two separate goals, and you can see them really, really clearly in the Tunisian cables, which is, one, we want allies, and two, we want the countries of the world to be democracies to the degree that they're democracies. We are presumably all better off and safer for all the reasons we know. And when those principles clash, as they did in Tunisia, where we had an ally who was an autocrat, it is a very complicated issue for the State Department. You could see this as the Tunisian uprising was beginning. Secretary Clinton went out and said, essentially, we're not taking sides in this fight, which was kind of extraordinary because it was, in as much as we want the countries of the world to be democracies, it was pretty clear where anybody's allegiance should lay in that particular struggle. And yet the Ben Ali regime had been an ally of the U.S. in the region. So the difficulty in promoting internet freedom, which was the title of Secretary Clinton's talk of a year ago as a sort of a new pillar of State Department policy, is that it runs aground on our temptation to essentially treat each other nation of the world with different local policies. So we made a much bigger deal about internet freedom vis-a-vis Iran and China than we do about Tunisia. So in the foreign affairs article, I'm essentially arguing for longer-term, lower public visibility attempts to essentially improve access to social media generally, but without explicit short-term political goals. And I think the core idea of the foreign affairs piece is that we've tended to overestimate the political value of access to information, right? The idea that someone, if given free access to Wikipedia and the New York Times, will then agitate for democracy. And we've underestimated the value of conversation, right? What really leads citizens to participate in the kind of public sphere that ends up demanding political change is the ability to coordinate with one another. So conversation is politically more important than information in terms of our policies towards internet freedom, and I was advocating, in part in the foreign affairs article, a reordering of reordering of state priorities to support conversation, and in part saying we simply shouldn't be advocating internet freedom in ways that are regime specific because it makes us look like hypocrites.
Gosh, are you saying that in First Amendment terms, freedom of speech is more important than freedom of the press? Or freedom of online assembly is more important than freedom of the press?
It's not that it's more important in terms of a right to be defended, but rather that the political effects have tended to be of political effects of social media have tended to be around coordination and not access to information. But the First Amendment bunches those rights together as a group, because the designers of the document said this is actually a coherent bundle. And you could see this. There's been a lot of talk about the degree to which Tunisia was a social media revolution, and it's a kind of a theological question that has no real answer. It just, yeah, just depends on how you define the terms. But one of the interesting parallels that was brought up was the French Revolution a newspaper revolution? And in France, in the 6 months leading up to the uprising in 1789, there were 200 new political newspapers formed in Paris alone. And the link, very clear at the time of the drafting of the First Amendment, between newspapers and political conversation and citizen participation could not have been clearer.
That's fascinating. And a Tunisian that we know told us that the Tunisian government actually created some fake Islamic extremist Facebook pages in order to falsely demonstrate what they're afraid of in terms of letting Tunisians use Facebook openly. Did you know about that?
Yes. No, it's this is what's called the dictator's dilemma, which is that once the communications landscape frees up, once people can actually talk to each other, what the dictators are stuck with is they can no longer rely on enforced silence, and so they have to resort to either censorship or propaganda, or in most cases, both. And the censorship is what happened after the Tunisian cables started to be circulated, right? The Ben Ali government was trying to crack down on those. And at the same time, they were going after this propaganda thing of trying to use either nationalist fervor or fear of Islamist takeover or what have you. It is the same set of techniques used in Iran during the Green Wave. It was a set of techniques used much more broadly but at lower intensity in China. Because really, when enforced silence is gone, censorship and propaganda are about all you've got before you start either arresting or killing your own citizens, which also sadly happened to me.
Let's take a phone call. Here's Matt in Essex County in New Jersey. Matt, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. Interesting topic. I just wanted to mention that Facebook is an interesting place, especially for people with lots of friends, and it's very political. And what I found is, as someone who's moved over from the Bible Belt and ended up on the East Coast, is that a lot of my friends that I've known for a long time, they're very candid with me about their politics are driven by their interpretation of the Bible. And I wanted to know if you guys would discuss that a little bit. It's kind of a little bit frightening, and it's quite a chasm to bridge between liberals and conservatives.
Give me an example.
I'd like to hear your thoughts on
that. Can you give me an example of what you've seen?
Oh, sure. There's a publication called The Thinker. It's some sort of conservative blog, and someone was writing a lot about how Sarah Palin was being denigrated because liberals felt that she was a pure, happy soul that needed to be ruined, I suppose, and they were jealous of her freedom, her intellectual freedom. And I simply made some comments that I didn't really think she was all that happy and pure. I thought she was like a lot of media figures, and that she was a little bit divisive and seemed angry. So we got into some spirited debate about that. That was one example.
All right. Thank you. Is it Clay Shirky? Think about this.
You know, yeah, certainly the ability to see what other people are thinking and saying has been a fairly profound shock to the American political scene, right? The idea that any liberal can go out and read what conservatives are saying to one another and vice versa. The old kind of Walter Cronkite consensus, the middle America, middle of the road consensus that was the normal fare available in the media landscape, we're long since gone from. The polarization has always been there, right? We've never, as a nation, had a really coherent set of core political beliefs. But what we have had is an enormous amount of geographic and rhetorical separation. So liberals weren't reading National Review and conservatives weren't reading Mother Jones and so forth. And the web obviously stirs all of that up and upsets everybody because we can now all see it all the time. Fortunately, I think, for us, and again, back to constitutional design, the design of the U.S. political system doesn't assume that eventually we'll all agree. It just provides a set of rules for losing. Right? So sometimes liberals lose when conservatives are in charge, and sometimes conservatives lose when liberals are in charge. But in a way, what's really important isn't that we convince each other, because we're operating from such different worldviews that that's unlikely, and much more that we kind of agree to disagree but remain committed to the enterprise. And I don't know whether or not the kind of stirring up that Facebook and blogs and Twitter does of seeing liberal and seeing conservative voices all mixed together is going to change that. But I think the commitment to being willing to lose to the other side from time to time and still remain part of the same republic is, in a way, not only much more important, it's a more practical goal than thinking we're all ever going to agree.
And for the most part, that's been an enduring value in American democracy, with the glaring exception of the Civil War, over 200-plus years. Clay Shirky is my guest on WNYC, author of Cognitive Surplus, Creativity and Generosity in a Connected Age. He wrote an article in Foreign Affairs about the political power of social media. So we're putting that in the context of Tunisia, the United States, and other countries. And here's Mary in New Brunswick. You're on WNYC. Hello. Mary, are you there? I think that Mary maybe can't hear me, so let's see if we can get back to Mary because I think she has an interesting question. And we're going to have to finish up in a minute, but you write in your article about the case of the Philippine president, Joseph Estrada, who was laid low by a text message revolution, but you contrast him with the failures of uprisings, like in Belarus, using social media against President Lukashenko, and in Iran against the government of Ahmadinejad. You know, how far away the Green Revolution and its Twitter element look now. And so you come to the conclusion that you were stating before, that it makes more sense to invest in social media in general and freedom of speech in social media in general, rather than specifically political tools to promote self-government. So how would the U.S. government do that? If this is a policy prescription for America as a superpower, how do we promote, you know, freedom of social media as a global value?
The incredibly awkward answer to that is that we do in many ways the opposite of what the government's reaction to WikiLeaks was, which is we make it hard for publicly available speech on the internet to be suppressed. There was a famous set of cases involving shopping malls in California during labor unrest and then the Vietnam War in the 60s, in which people pointed out that in the United States, public space was increasingly commercially owned, but where citizens went out and interacted with one another just as a side effect of being out and about were now shopping malls where it wasn't public in the governmentally owned sense of the word. And a set of rules were created which essentially said there is some public speech that has to be allowed even in commercial environments. And when you see WikiLeaks, which is plainly a media outlet, getting kicked off of some list by Amazon and Visa and PayPal and MasterCard and so on, with much less process than it takes to get onto a terrorist watch list, that is exactly the kind of thing the U.S. should be against if we want to promote internet freedom. But in the case of WikiLeaks, our narrow, you know, the narrow conception of self-interest and the short-term conception of self-interest led us to push against exactly what we're going to have to be pushing for in the long term if we want the idea of internet freedom to matter.
And I think that's what Mary in New Brunswick was calling about in the first place.
Can you hear me?
Yes, Mary, we got you now. And you wanted to talk about Anonymous and the hacktivists involved in defending WikiLeaks rights, right?
Exactly. Yeah, I love the show, by the way. But
thank
after
you.
Like Julian Assange was denied bail, I remember the hacktivists jumped in, and I had started following them. It's like the Anonymous News Network on Facebook. And like a week before I even started hearing about the Tunisian protests on NPR or even, you know, Al Jazeera English, Anonymous, because they're like, you know, like Anonymous activists all over the world, they had people that were kind of making the videos, and I had just heard about it. It was like days and days before it ever hit, you know, even quasi-mainstream media. And in that way, like, I mean, well, I have 350 friends and I'm reposting or whatever. And so at least if they're watching me and they haven't unblocked me, so, you know, they can, you know, they can understand. And I'm just saying it furthers the conversation, even if, like, I'm being involved. It kind of spread that faster.
Mary, thank you very much. And we have to leave it there. We're going to give Mary the last word. With Clay Shirky, author of the book Cognitive Surplus, Creativity and Generosity in a Connected Age, his recent article in Foreign Affairs about the political power of social media. I have a feeling this is not the last conversation we'll have on this topic.
Probably not.
Thanks a lot, Clay.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, in fact, you can start calling right now. It's a call-in for immigrants from anywhere. On the question, are you a Chinese mom? You know that book that everyone's talking about by Amy Schwa, which has the author explaining what is and what isn't actually Chinese about her strict approach to parenting? So we're going to take calls from you immigrants from anywhere on whether your culture's parenting style is Chinese too. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 with an Amy Schwa clip coming up right after this.